Welcome to Divorce Explained, the podcast where we answer your questions and navigate the process of divorce together. Sharing real stories and personal experiences, this is your guide through it all. With your hosts, family law specialist Steve Benmore and divorce lawyer and strategist Leanne Townsend.
All right, so today's subject is actually very interesting. 20 years ago, if I introduced this subject, nobody would have any idea what we're talking about. But today, we're talking about spouses hacking into digital data of their spouse while, or even before, they're going through separation and divorce. And so this is a very complicated area and one that's evolving very quickly. And in fact, we're going to share with you some recent law on the subject matter, but let's just go backwards. What are we really talking about here? Does it really matter that a husband went into his wife's iPhone and downloaded a picture of them at a Christmas party? Nobody cares about that. But what happens when the spouse goes into the other spouse's iPhone or tablet or social media account and collects data that the spouse, number one, expected to be private, and then they use that data as part of a court case in family court against spouse number one? And what do we do about that if you're spouse number one? And what do we do about that if you're spouse number two? And that's what we're going to be talking about today. The use of private digital data by one spouse against the other when they're going through separation and divorce. And so let's just roll right into the law. So there is this concept. It's actually an equitable doctrine called a reasonable expectation of privacy. So in the old days, pre-social media, pre-internet, something like a diary was something that most people on the streets of the world would say, entries in a diary, that's private. The person who filled in information in a diary expected no one else to read it unless they shared the entry with someone else. There was a reasonable expectation of privacy. So if the husband kept a journal, a diary, and he wrote down his personal thoughts, his feelings, whether those feelings were amorous towards his wife, whether those feelings were detestable, maybe he wrote down that he committed infidelity, whether he wrote down that he had suicidal ideations. There was an expectation that whatever he wrote down in his diary was private. And if the wife went into his diary and took photocopies of it and then used it in court, the court would likely say she violated its privacy. Okay, so that's an easy one. But what happens if the husband took the diary and he took it to Second Cup or Tim Hortons and he left it on the counter and he deliberately left it on the counter, not by accident? He has now divulged or waived the reasonable expectation of privacy. So now let's apply old school thinking to digital data. So there's data that somebody might have on their hard drive. So same idea like the diary one, but now it's just on their hard drive or on their iPhone. But what happens if they take that data and they put it on Instagram or LinkedIn or Facebook? Is there a reasonable expectation of privacy? Probably not. They've now publicized it, just like the example that I gave of the person that takes their diary and deliberately leaves it in a coffee shop for the world to see. So, and now we've got these cases where some people say, well, we shared an Apple account and we always read each other's information, or he gave me his passwords and I always would look at his phone to find out where he's going to be so we can make family plans. Was there a reasonable expectation of privacy? Well, if they used to share passwords in order to go into each other's phone or tablet or social media account, maybe not. Then along comes separation and divorce. Does the past pattern apply to the post-separation conduct? Or does separation automatically mean that if you used to go into your spouse's account. You now no longer can, because the act of separation has now established a reasonable expectation of privacy. These are really complicated questions. And where it gets really dicey is where the evidence is really important. So for example, a parenting dispute in divorce, where the data might actually reveal things that place the child at risk, like drug use, prostitution, criminal behavior. And one spouse hacks that information, wants to present it to the judge. Will the judge allow that in or not? And so we're in this funny place right now where, is it private or is it public? Is it probative, which is another way to say, is it important for the judge to see to prove a point or not? And which factor weighs heavily more against the other? In other words, the right to privacy or the right to ensure that the children are safe, because there's a potential threat that will not be identified unless the private information is revealed. And so we are in that funny place. And I'm going to hear from you, Leanne, on that. And then we'll talk a little bit about some case law.
I think it's in some ways, I think the law is just trying to catch up with situations that are, you know, have already been developing for a while and continue to develop, because, you know, it's a very real issue. The thought of spouses hacking, you know, the other spouse's, you know, emails or Facebook accounts or, you know, whatever it might be. And as you mentioned, Steve, it is complicated, because where, you know, there may be a fine line between where there's a reasonable expectation of privacy or there isn't. You know, if you were in a situation where when you were together, you had full access to your spouse's email or their Facebook or their IG, and you're now separated and none of the passwords have been changed or anything. So, you know, is there a reasonable expectation of privacy in that situation, or is there not? And if the password has been changed, does that make the argument better that there's a reasonable expectation of privacy? So, you know, all of these types of cases would be very fact specific. And it's interesting, because I actually had a situation with a client many years back where his ex-spouse had opened his mail. His mail had accidentally, something had come to where she was living, because she was in the matrimonial home, and it was addressed to him, only him, and she had opened it. And so there became an issue there. Did she violate his privacy by opening his mail? And she actually uncovered some information that was very detrimental to him that she would never have known about. But she shouldn't have been opening his mail at the end of the day. So that was very much a live issue. And I had another situation with a client. This was, to me, really interesting. Was she had access to her ex's email, and she was reading his communications with his lawyer, which I quickly had to shut down with her very quickly, that she should not be doing that. That could be a situation where, you know, it was really to his detriment, because she's reading the legal advice that the lawyer is actually giving him in the matter that she's involved in. So that was a really, you know, unfortunate situation to arise and be involved in. And certainly that's not something I recommend people do, in that type of situation.
Well, let's talk about some real quirky situations, and then let's jump into some case law. I've had in the last 15, 20 years, quite a few of them, just like you, Leanne, and some of these, you know, you really scratch your head. So I had one case ages ago where the wife's email was, she got a new phone, husband set up a new phone for her when times were good. And when he set up the new phone for her, every time she pressed send on an email, he was automatically BCC'd. So, and it was done for good reason, in case, you know, he needed to have access to it, in case her phone was lost. You know, it was a valid plan. It's just that she didn't really even either know about it or remember that he did it. And then they split up years later, and the same platform was in existence. so that every email that she pressed send on, which by the way, sometimes included an email to her that she hit reply so that he would read the email that came in and the email that went out. And so the question becomes, did he do anything wrong? I mean, this was something that was going on for many, many years. That's one example. Another example is now we've got plenty of technological tools such as Apple AirTags. Apple AirTags oftentimes are in bags, purses, shoes, luggage, and whoever during the course of the marriage might have, for very good reason, installed it in order to always be able to find a purse, a piece of luggage, whatever the case may be. And then they split up. And now one is tracking the other one. And there's been stories about this where somebody goes to an examination for discovery or questioning and said, where did you go last Wednesday between 5 and 8? And the person's like, because they did something wrong between 5 and 8. And they didn't think anybody knew that. And now this person's got evidence that they were somewhere, and that evidence is in the Apple technology platform that shows where the Apple AirTag was. Another one is couples that split up oftentimes have alarm systems that include videos. And the videos could sometimes contain very inappropriate information, like, for example, yelling at the children or physical discipline, or potentially somebody coming in the house at late hours after the kids go to sleep, maybe a partner, maybe a girlfriend, maybe a boyfriend. And so the question becomes, well, who is the alarm account's name in? And if the account on the alarm is in the name of the person that is reading it, watching it, using it, have they done anything wrong? Because the spouse that's actually being caught in it, first of all, is doing something wrong. And second of all, should they not know? Another example, and this happens all the time, a lot of families have phone accounts like Rogers, Telus, Bell. Well, a lot of people don't know this, but the person that owns the account can access all of the data on the phone, including numbers dialed and received, length of call, long distance calls. There's a lot of data in the cell phone account, and it actually could be extremely valuable in a divorce case. And so a lot of people don't think that when they split up, they should ditch their phone account, in fact, even their provider, and get a brand new phone. Some people don't think to close down every one of their social media accounts, Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, and open up new ones, because you don't know if the spouse will be able to go into the account and access old data. The old data might actually just be photographs of a trip 3 years ago where everybody was getting drunk and there were a whole bunch of bottles of alcohol behind them. And then now that's going to be used in order to establish a case that the person is an alcoholic. So on my website, for example, I have a section under helpful links that says social media reminders and what to do and what not to do vis-a-vis social media when you're splitting up, because it's a treasure trove of data. And we can worry later about whether it's a violation of privacy or it's a reasonable expectation of privacy, but you really don't want to even have that argument because you don't want that data out there.
No, absolutely. It's something that I think more and more people need to be very mindful of. You know, we're always telling people to be careful about what they're posting during separation and divorce, but you know, this is a whole different issue of being mindful of what you've already posted and your spouse's access to it. So it's something for all, you know, people who are in the process of separating or newly separated to think about. Make sure that you've taken steps to protect your privacy with respect to social media accounts, email accounts, and then, you know, bank accounts and a whole gamut of the, you know, credit cards, that financial information as well. It's very important.
Very good point, by the way. Think about the data contained in a visa bill. And that visa bill, in fact, I had a case a couple of years ago where it was the claim made against my client was that he was an alcoholic. The visa bill was a very important piece of evidence against him, because what it showed was not only the amount of trips to the liquor store, which quite frankly was damaging unto itself, but the location that were connected with various retail activity was also very important. So for example, it would have locations of retail places that were right next door, either to a sexual massage parlor or a strip club. And the argument that the wife was making was that not only was he getting drunk, but he was getting drunk and he was going to these places while she was at home with the kids. And the pattern was very hard to escape, because why is it that over the course of a month or two, it was that liquor store or that variety store or that Burger King that he went to, of all the places in the world? Why is it that always the one right next to, fill in the blank, the Brass Rail or some sexual massage parlor? And so this was critical information. And so the question becomes, did she violate his privacy when she accessed the family visa, the joint visa cards statements? And turns out in my case, it wasn't, and it was used against him. But my point is, you gotta be really careful. And you know, in some cases, people are better off either paying in cash or buying credit cards from a shopper's where you are given like $100 or $500 of a usage on it, where there's actually no data, because the data from the use of credit cards or Interact could be very damaging in a divorce case. Okay, let's talk about that case that you sent to me, Leanne, Chen and Huang, interesting case. And for those that know how to use Canly is the search engine for court cases in Canada, and it's canlii.org. And you could certainly keyword search under Ontario Cheng Wang 2024, and it's case number 1173. This was a case where the husband openly hacked the wife's information, and the wife asked the judge to make a ruling that she wasn't asking for money and she wasn't asking for anything in particular other than a finding, a declaration that he hacked her account. And she's going to deal with that later at trial. And in this case, the judge made that finding, mainly because the husband admitted to it all. But what this case also did was it reminded us of new law that was created back in 2012 by the Court of Appeal in the case of Jones versus Tsig, spelled T-S-I-G-E. And that was a 2012 case decided by the Ontario Court of Appeal, completely different facts and not directly a family law case, but it established a tort. What's a tort? A tort is a violation or a breach of a duty of care. So a tort is where someone does something wrong. Another word for tort is a wrongdoing or a malfeasance. In this case, the Court of Appeal case, Jones and Tsig, the court said, if you can prove these three things, we will find that the person committed the tort of intrusion upon seclusion. Really fancy language to simply mean you violated somebody's privacy. So seclusion is another word for privacy. I expect it to be secluded. Intrusion is when somebody intruded on my privacy. So really, in simple language, intrusion upon seclusion, or the tort of intrusion upon seclusion, is just another way of saying breach of somebody's privacy. And the court said that if you can prove these three things, and they have to be conjunctive, you can't prove only one or two, you have to prove all three. And what are the three? That the person that did the breaching did it intentionally, or did it recklessly. In other words, they should have known better. they did not have lawful right to do it. Three, it is offensive, distressing, humiliating. It causes anguish, one of those things. And that a, quote, reasonable person would think that this is highly offensive. So, and that is when I said to you earlier how the law is evolving. Because what might have been considered offensive 20 years ago in terms of violating one's privacy may not necessarily be that offensive today. So for example, outing a same-sex couple 20 years ago might have been considered offensive. But today, it's part of common language. And so is it offensive to reveal that somebody has a particular sexuality? I don't know. Maybe yes, maybe not. We're living in that morphing, evolving window where social mores are changing. So when the case of Jones and Sig said, would a reasonable person believe that this is offensive? That changes over time. And so that is the test. Just to recap, it's intentional or reckless. They didn't have the right to do it, and it's offensive. You prove those three, a judge can make the finding that this is a breach of privacy, it's intrusion upon seclusion, and in Jones and Sig, the person was awarded $20,000 in compensation for that, which some might say that's a lot of money, some might say that's little considering the damage that it was causing. But, and of course, that's also going to change. In other words, the more offensive versions might cause a judge to grant far more in compensation, but that will evolve over time as well.
And that's what I thought was kind of interesting in this Chang and Huang case is the wife in that case was only seeking, as you mentioned, Steve, like a declaration that the husband had hacked her email and you know, done this, committed the tort of inclusion.
Intrusion of seclusion.
That's right. I have to have it in front of me to always remember the exact wording. Even when I had a case that had this tort in it, I always was getting it right. But the judge did go on to say that if the wife had asked in for damages, she had not in her pleadings for this, but if she had, the judge would have considered awarding her damages. So if you're out there and you're in a situation like this where your spouse has hacked your email or you have proof of it and you're wanting to know what your remedies could be, you could potentially receive some amount of damages for your privacy being violated in that way.
Yeah, we're in a whole new era because it used to be when people would come and hire family law lawyers, the sort of remedies that were available in any average divorce was a divorce order, parenting rights like custody or access, child support, spousal support, and then property division and something to do with the home. That was pretty much it. It was a very short list of menu items. But in the last few years, partly because of the development of technology and partly because of very creative judges and lawyers, a lot of the remedies that we have today are new. You know, we've got some sort of basic remedies like occupation rent when someone stays in the house longer than they should and they don't agree to sell the house quickly. Somebody that's not in the home could say, look, you know what, they lived in the house longer than me and I wanted the home sold and I want them to pay me rent. That's a basic one. But in the field of social development and IT development, you've got situations where people are suing for what we just described, intrusion upon seclusion. And then in the field of family violence, we are now in an era where people are in fact suing for compensation for the suffering that they endured during the marriage. And, you know, for many, many years, certainly for the first 15, 20 years of my practice, when clients would complain about how their spouse treated them, we sadly had to explain to them that conduct is not relevant unless it goes directly to the heart of parenting. And conduct, generally speaking, doesn't affect any of the financial rights. But now we're finding torts for violence, for emotional abuse, for hacking emails. These are now part and parcel of family law cases. And the people that are choosing to pursue those rights, in effect, are choosing to go to trial, because I have never had a case where people agree to an amount in compensation for intrusion upon seclusion or family violence. Those are cases that are doing a beeline right to trial, while at the same time, most people really don't want to go to court, let alone go to trial. So we're in a, like, there's the right, and then there's the functional ability to obtain the right. And so we're in that funny place right now.
Well, I think bottom line, if our listeners, the takeaway from our live today is that if you are thinking of hacking your spouse's or your former spouse's email or their social media or their electronic messages, don't do it.
Amen.
Thanks everyone for joining us. We'll be back again next week for another episode of Divorce Explained. Bye for now.
Thanks for tuning in to today's episode of Divorce Explained. If you enjoyed it, don't forget to head on over to Instagram and follow at Steve Benmore and at Leanne Townsend Life for more. And if you're looking for specific divorce services, you can visit benmore.com and leannetownsend.ca. We hope today's episode made you feel informed and inspired as you move along through your divorce journey. Tune in next week for Divorce Explained.